12 and 13 biennium, it's a total of about 19.5 billion. For the 10-11 biennium, it's a total of 15.2. So that's a bit more than a $4 billion biennial increase in total dollars. And with a state share of 50%, that's where the $2 billion comes from. The $2 billion figure, which is doing it this way, it's actually accounting for the whole thing instead of 70%. For sure. But that's what. If you look at the total expenditure, it's not exact, but it's enough to confirm that there is a growth in the neighborhood of $2 billion state funds in medical assistance. There are some issues. Some of the services don't have a state share. They're paid by the counties. So it would make the picture a little bit different, but at a 50% federal share, there's a growth, a biennial growth in the neighborhood of $2 billion for the biennial.
And that was in the original forecast, right?
It was in the original forecast, yes, Mr. Chairman. And what is important in that original forecast is that there's another $1.5 billion of biennial difference, which is a financing difference. It's the result of the federal government giving $1.5 billion of enhanced funding in 10 and 11, and that amount of enhanced funding is not there in 12 and 13. What we're seeing in the Minnesota Care Program is a very rapid and very large increase in enrollment. It started in the spring of 2010. We have been seeing record numbers of applications month after month through the summer and into the fall. And as a result, we have a big increase in the Minnesota Care expenditure forecast. We are increasing the forecast in enrollment of adults without children by about a third. They were up. Enrollment of adults without children in Minnesota Care.
You have a breakdown on what their incomes are? I mean, how many are below 75% of poverty, for instance?
It's still about half and half, Mr. Chairman. The enrollment before these big increases was about half under 75% of poverty, and the big growth in enrollment is still about half under 75 of poverty. And so we're seeing a dramatic growth, but not as great in the enrollment of the children and parents. And there our increase in forecast is about 20% in 12 and 13. So it's dramatic, but it's not as dramatic as the adults without children. Now, we know the economy has something to do with this. What's a bit odd is that we are not seeing anything out of the ordinary in medical assistance enrollment. We are seeing medical assistance enrollment of children and parents very much in line with our forecast. And we saw the biggest increase in medical assistance enrollment in 2010 compared to fiscal year 2009. If we look at children and parents in MA rather than Minnesota Care, we knew we were going to get fairly dramatic increases because of the recession. We had a 7% increase in fiscal 09 over fiscal 08. We had a further 11.6% increase in fiscal 10 over fiscal 09. And we're forecasting this year 7.5% higher than last year. And that was largely expected from the time we knew we were going to have the recession. We've had to make a couple of small adjustments in that forecast. What has happened with the Minnesota Care families is entirely different. Enrollment of Minnesota Care families actually fell 4% in fiscal 09 over fiscal 08. It rose only 3% in fiscal 10. And now it looks like it's up 24% in fiscal 11. And so it looks like a late wave of families affected by the economy. Most of these applications are coming in from the counties, so a lot of these are people going to the counties, applying for assistance, getting sent on to the state for Minnesota Care, and getting on the Minnesota Care program. Now, something similar is happening with the adults without kids, but even stronger. And we think part of that is that we allowed too much savings for the elimination of transitional Minnesota Care in connection with the GAMC bill last spring. We think part of the reason we have such a dramatic increase on the adults, only part though, because we see this happening with families too, is that we thought a lot of the transitional Minnesota Care costs were going to be avoided. What we think we're seeing is that they're finding their way into the program faster than we thought they were going to. And we're still basically paying the cost for this whole transitional Minnesota Care group. Now, if you know the history of this is a group which was part of the GAMC population, started to be referred to Minnesota Care in the fall of 2006. Still had a distinct eligibility, partly paid by GAMC, partly by the Minnesota Care program, until the GAMC bill changed the program last spring and eliminated transitional Minnesota Care as a separate coverage. So we tell anybody that we're not happy with the forecast performance we've had so far, and this always prompts us to go back and say what did we miss? Why is this happening? I don't. Outside of the economy and the effects of the economy, we have a suspicion that some of it's coming from people hearing about healthcare reform and pursuing healthcare benefits because they heard about this and it's supposed to be started already.
Well, Mr. Hoffman, I can tell you that there are some provider groups that are using charities basically to pay for people to get on Minnesota Care that would have been on GAMC in the past. Ooh. And so there's a significant effort to get these people into Minnesota Care.
I've been saying to people in the department, it sure looks to me like an outreach effect. But we haven't been able to pin down who is doing the outreach. We know that there are some counties paying premiums, but there were some counties paying premiums before, and we have not yet been able to pin down the source of a large effect on the enrollment. Now, this forecast is complicated by the issue of early expansion of medical assistance for adults without kids. I've been describing the forecast changes in a way which applies roughly equally well as a change from the forecast with optional expansion. If you look at the picture on page 26 of the document that has been handed out to members, it's a picture of the change in forecast of enrollment of adults without kids with MA optional expansion. And so fiscal 11 enrollment, that high point there is about 63,000 people. That's a lot higher than the end of session forecast. It's more than 23,000 higher. Part of that's because of the delay in the assumption about when early enrollment was going to start. And part of it's the generally higher enrollment in the base forecast in Minnesota Care. And the question that the chair asked earlier about how these people were split, they're split. This higher enrollment is split in such a way that about half of that higher enrollment goes into the early expansion, and about half of that higher enrollment stays in the Minnesota Care forecast.
That's assuming that the early expansion goes only to 75% of poverty, correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And if you look again at this picture, we also recognize in 14 and 15 the effect of the mandatory expansion up to 133% of the poverty level, and that's why the forecasted enrollment falls off in 14 and 15. That's the effect of the mandatory expansion moving all the Minnesota Care enrollees under 133 of poverty starting in January of 14. So it's a half year in 14, and it's a full year in 15, and moving them into medical assistance as part of the mandatory expansion.
Well, Mr. Hoffman, maybe you can just clarify for me. If this curves you have here are 75% of poverty, and the chunk of people that are above that, adults without kids, is also going up, and we're putting them in Minnesota Care, and where the state basically pays 100%. What would happen if we, instead of going to 75% of poverty, we went to 133? Would we actually save the state money. If you look at both the healthcare access fund and the general fund,
the effect of the early expansion of medical assistance is if I take a full year, fiscal year 2012, our forecast of the MA state share cost of early expansion is $482 million. Our forecast of the Minnesota Care savings is $396 million. And that is typical of how this looks in the forecast in 12 and 13. The cost of the 50% state share in the general fund is about $100 million more than the forecasted cost of the Minnesota Care savings. Now, if you consider that we have a GAMC program funded at about $100 million a year, and you can, and the early expansion law says that when MA early expansion is triggered, the new GAMC program is terminated, that makes GAMC savings of about $100 million a year available to help pay for the early expansion. And so the result in crude terms is that it's about cost neutral for the state. It's about cost neutral for the state to have a more generous MA program for this population with a more expensive benefit that will draw in some additional uninsured people. The cost of the 50% share of that is in our estimates roughly equal to the state savings of getting those people off of Minnesota Care at 100% state cost, plus the GAMC savings, the savings of eliminating GAMC funding. It's approximately cost neutral. So I would say that expanding early expansion to a higher income level probably wouldn't change that picture. It would still be roughly cost neutral. Because it in a sense, it would be more of the same. It would be more of, we have a more expensive benefit, we draw in some additional people, but we pay only half. And then we get the Minnesota Care savings of getting people off of Minnesota Care.
And that would give them a benefit that included basically all their hospital costs instead of the $10,000 limitation.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. We are figuring that the average cost of coverage in medical assistance would be about 20% higher, and 11 points of the 20% increase is for the comprehensive inpatient benefit compared to the Minnesota Care benefit, and the most of the rest is a matter of anticipating that to get CMS certification of the capitation rates and medical assistance, that we will have to pay somewhat higher rates.
Okay, just go ahead then.
There is also a picture, if you turn a page, There's also a picture on page 28 of the enrollment forecast without MA optional expansion. And here in 12 and 13, the new forecast is a bit more than a third higher, and you still see the enrollment falling off because we get to the mandatory expansion in 14 and 15. So,
and at that point, the feds will pay 100% as well.
At that point, the feds will pay 100% of the federally qualified people. We're assuming in the forecast of the early expansion that 1% of the enrollees will not be federally eligible because of immigration status. Basically, that they would fall under the five-year bar. If you are in a period within 5 years of entering the United States and you're not a refugee or asylee, mostly you are barred from medical from federal funding of Medicaid for a period of 5 years. So on the mandatory expansion, we are forecasting a 1% state share for the 1% who are not federally eligible. There is still some uncertainty about 100% or 75% federal share. There's a lack of clarity in the federal law. 100% seems much more likely, but there is a possibility that the decision would go the other way.
Is that your presentation, Mr. Huff?
That's the presentation, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Hoffman? Thank you, and you've certainly given us more to think about than I thought we were going to be thinking about. And next we have Brian Osberg.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Brian Osberg, State Medicaid Director, and you've asked for an update in terms of the early option around Medicaid and our preparation for that. We are prepared at this point to submit a state plan amendment once an executive order is issued by the governor, and we have developed plans to implement this, and those plans can be triggered as soon as that executive order is issued. Fortunately, we have to submit a state plan amendment as opposed to submitting a waiver. A waiver would take much more time and much more complex. We have no concerns, frankly, of getting approval from CMS on a state plan amendment. Certainly, they have authorized this through, of course, the federal health care reform law. Just to remind everyone, and you mentioned this already, the early expansion is for adults without dependent children up to 75% of the federal poverty guideline. What we did last spring when this was discussed by the legislature, we talked to CMS about the prospect of taking one of our current programs, like medical assistance for parents, or a Minnesota Care program for adults without kids, or our old GAMC program that we had for adults without kids, and taking that and making that available. They said no to that, and they still say no to that.
Could you go over that again?
Sure. As you recall, the discussions last spring, we went to CMS and said, what will it take for us to develop the early Medicaid option? What provisions are going to be required for that option? And so we said, can we simply take one of our current programs that we have for parents, for example, or for parents for medical assistance that we have, And we have a program, as you know, for adults without kids in Minnesota Care. And we have a program for adults without kids in GAMC. Can we just take one of those and convert it to this new option? They said no. So what we had to do is develop
And it was that because they have different benefit packages?
It's primarily because they would not accept a asset test, because the new law does not provide for an asset test in 2014. They would not accept an asset test for the early Medicaid option either. And of course, the legislation that was enacted last year does not have an asset test. So we put into place, the legislature put into place, a program that would be acceptable to CMS. We combined three programs. We combined GAMC in terms of how we calculate income. We took medical assistance parents program as to how we define benefits. And then we took the new law around the asset test. So combining those three provisions, the new federal law, combining those three provisions, we developed a whole new eligibility program. And that is what is before us in terms of the what we need to implement and develop in the next few months. Now, we have also seen Connecticut and Washington, D.C. go through the process of getting a state plan amendment, and they had no problems at all with that. Those are the only other states or jurisdictions that have enacted an early option, is, again, Washington, D.C. And the state of Connecticut. So we watched that carefully. They had no problems at all getting that state plan approved. So we would submit the state plan amendment right away. Now, the issue, however, is that the state plan amendment is not effective until the program is operational. Because, of course, until we have demonstrated and we have up and running the program that we're talking about, they will not provide for federal funding. As you mentioned, 50% federal money, not 100% federal money like it will be in 2014. And certainly in 2014, states will be required to provide coverage to all adults, not just adults without kids, but all adults, including parents, up to 133% of the federal poverty guideline. But at that point, we will receive 100% federal funding, and then it goes down to 90% over time. The other issue, Mr. Chairman, that was talked about last year and that was incorporated in the language is that what kind of benefit set can we make available to this population, or do we have to make available to this population? The new federal reform law said that you can offer a benchmark benefit set to this population in 2014, not unlike what we would receive as state employees, for example. However, when the guidance came out in the summertime as to what that means, it became clear. In fact, the guidance we received back during legislative session, it became clear that we needed to include the entire Medicaid benefit set for this population and not something less than that. And so, as you know, the legislation has the full Medicaid benefit set in it. We have not received any further guidance from CMS. In fact, I just asked them this past week, is there any guidance forthcoming in terms of what the benchmark benefit set may look like and who's exempt from that benchmark benefit set and is entitled to the full Medicaid benefits? They said, no, not for the early option, there won't be any further guidance, but for 2014 there will be. Because, as you may know, through the Legislative Healthcare Access Commission work, HHS is working on what's called the essential benefit set for the exchange, which is going to be very similar to the benchmark benefit set for Medicaid. Because in 2014, we will have the spectrum of coverage for people between 0 and 400%, up to 133% for Medicaid, and up to 400% between 133 and 400 for people in the exchange. And so they haven't defined yet what this essential benefit set is going to look like. They haven't defined yet what the benchmark benefit set looks like. So we can't come back to the legislature this session and say we recommend now introducing the benchmark benefit set because it's still not clear who will be exempt from that.
But in the interim, we'd be using the MA benefit set.
We will be using, Mr. Chairman, yes, we will have, and that's what's in the legislation today. In fact, if you recall, there was about a 7% differential in terms of cost between a benchmark or the old GAMC benefit set and the Medicaid benefit set.
And did they both, does MA in Minnesota covers dental, and did we cover dental in the GAMC?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we did. Now, we've changed the benefit in dental for both medical assistants. And now in the new GAMC program, we do not cover dental, as you know, but the old one we did.
So, you, Mr. Osberg, you said that you have the plan ready to go, or the state plan amendment. And but you said it would take some time to implement that. And could you explain to me why it would take time?
Mr. Chairman, no, the state plan amendments, we don't have to implement that. That's simply getting approval from the federal government for what we're doing. And that can be approved within the quarter, the time period in which we get in operations. What I said is it's going to take some time, and what I've been informed by our systems and operational people, they'll take 9 months to fully develop, design, and convert, and then implement this new program, because of the magnitude is, again, major eligibility system, and we can have somebody come in and explain exactly why it takes that long, but it's everything from doing systems conversion on one system and do a manual conversion on another, because we have Maxis, and which is now supports our medical assistance programs, and we have MMMIS, which supports Minnesota Care. So we have to do conversions in both of those programs, and then we have to fully design this and train counties in a new program and operationalize this. So it's a systems development activity and operational development activity that our systems and operational people say would take 9 months to do it correctly.
So Mr. Osberg, then we would let's assume it was the last day of the ninth month. Then we could go retroactive for 3 months. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, in terms of retroactive coverage, there's two aspects to that. One is that, right, in fact, that's one thing that CMS insisted on, is that our new program needed to have a retroactive coverage, meaning 90 days. You could pick up expenses that are incurred by the individual 90 days prior to the effective date of their of eligibility. That's true today in our medical assistance programs. Now, in terms of what costs, state costs are eligible for retroactive coverage, that's a different situation. There, Mr. Chairman, what has to happen is that once the program's up and running, then any state expenses we have in GAMC or Minnesota Care after that time for people who are otherwise eligible for Medicaid, for the new Medicaid program, that we can go back and seek 50% federal match for. But that you can't do that until it's up and operating. So there's retroactive coverage of costs for the individual. That's 90 days prior to the day of their application. And then there's the retroactive recovery, if you will, of costs incurred by the state to our state programs once the program's up and running, for those who otherwise would have been eligible for that Medicaid program. And we can put this in writing for you, but...
I would like it in writing, but it seems to me that this was passed in May of this year, and the Department of Human Services could have been getting ready for this 7 months you've had already to get ready, and why aren't you ready?
Mr. Chairman, it was not known, and it still is now, at this point, widely speculated that there's going to be an executive order issued by the governor, but it was not known to the agency as to whether or not that indeed was going to be the case. It would have been not prudent for the agency to develop all the costs associated with this if not knowing whether or not an executive order was going to be issued. Now, as I said, plans have been developed, and they're ready to go and to be triggered for this, but the agency was not in a position to actually develop the new program without that executive order being issued.
Well, Mr. Asberg, your inability to get ready means that our providers will continue to lose about $880,000 a day for another 9 months, not counting the 6 months we've already not done it. And so your department has cost the providers of this state, I would say, how much? Well, you know, $900,000 a day, you've blown a year. That's a lot of money. And I would suggest that you start getting your people ready to do the changes that they need to get done, and it better not take 9 months.
Mr. Chairman, again, the agency does what it's instructed to do, and the agency was not in a position to operationalize this program without the issuance of an executive order. That was made real clear to us.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I would flip that and say it was prudent to do the planning because there was a high probability that an executive order might be given. But my question is now with Mr. Osberg's last comment, was the department given a directive from some source not to begin to do any planning?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, no, that's not what I meant. What it meant is that we were not, the staff who operationalized this, we're told that at this point we're not in a position to develop this and expend resources because we had other things we needed to accomplish, including implementing other aspects of state law, of course, this past session. It became clear that unless an executive order has been issued, that the agency is not to expend resources to do this.
So there is not, Mr. Chairman, a directive from higher up in the executive branch outside the department, let me put it that way, to not beginning any planning process. You weren't prevented from doing that. It was a departmental decision then about the expenditure of funds.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, we did the planning process. The planning process was done, and that is complete. But we were not, I'm not aware of being instructed by anybody outside the department.
The reason I raised that question, there was some publicity, with the governor on some other health-related issues and maybe other areas had indicated that nothing could be done in terms of applying for funds unless the governor had approved it or would approve it, and that's where I was headed if there was any direction from basically the governor's office, but you're saying there wasn't.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krause, I'm not aware of such direction.
No, thank you.
Well, I mean, this is, I guess, hearsay, but it's my understanding, and you can ask the health plans, that they were meeting with the Commissioner of Commerce because they have antitrust problems. They can't talk to each other unless the regulator is there, and they were looking at how to start the no pre-existing conditions for kids up to 19, I believe, and that they supposedly were ordered by the governor to, the commissioner was ordered to quit holding these meetings, and so the plans couldn't figure out how to do this in a timely fashion. So there's at least one case where the governor is, if that is true, stopped the implementation of the federal law. Any questions for Mr. Osberg? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Osberg, It's been a long 4 years. I think why I am struggling and, you know, experiencing a sense of suspended reality is because in the last year, we were going to, on nearly a dime, transition the population served in GAMC into Minnesota Care from, you know, one system to another, auto enrollment. It was going to be easy. It was going to be expedited. It was a difficult population, and we were going to do that within months. And then on a second dime, because we changed the law, we transitioned from old GAMC to CCDS with an enrollment system that involved the state and counties. And so twice in the past year, we have watched the department, and I understand that this is difficult, but the department has done yeoman's duty in trying to transition large public programs from one to another, making a transition between the systems, and they did it. And since last May, I have watched you and others testify to the difficulty of transitioning people in current public programs into medical assistance, a program that has been in law since like 1967. I understand that it's difficult, but I've seen the Department of Human Services twice do this in this year, and that's why it is very difficult for me to buy what you are selling right now. Can you let me know, in 2005, I understand there was federal money available, a 90% federal match to upgrade the system, Maxis. Did the state take advantage of that?
Mr. Chairman, Asbury. Representative Murphy, in 2005?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Before Chairman, I was Representative elected. Murphy, until about a month ago, only 50% federal match is available for states to develop eligibility systems, and they have now changed that. In fact, it's not effective quite yet because they're going through a rulemaking process, mm-hmm. and that was very fortunate because we're gonna need at least 90% federal money to do that. In fact, it's still gonna be a challenge for the state to come up with 10%. Match to develop the eligibility system to support the insurance exchange and Medicaid, which is what we need to do to be effective in getting the exchange up and running. And so there was not, in 2005, there was not that available to us at all. That would have been nice. There's 90% money for development of MMIS systems, claims payment systems, but not for eligibility systems, okay. Which is what we have to change here, Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, is all the systems, but and we don't have to necessarily automate the eligibility system to do this. We're not suggesting that. That needs to be done. That'll be done, hopefully, in the context of developing the insurance exchange and our new Medicaid reform provisions in 2014. But what we're talking about, and I don't know the technical detail, and our people can come and explain this to you. I mean, it's not me telling you this. It's our systems and operational people saying this is what it takes to do this right. And I haven't second-guessed them on that. We've asked, are you sure? Can we do it quicker than that? Because we knew there'd be interest in doing it quicker than that. We said, to do this correctly and to do it based on what's in front of us, this is what it's going to take. Now, we can get into detail of that mm-hmm. and at some point if you wish. It's nobody's interest necessarily to do this any longer than it takes. Nothing suggesting that we should delay implementing this. I can assure you there's no instruction to do that.
Mr. Chair, I'm pretty sure there was a press statement made by the current governor about the delay of any implementation of early MA, you know, early in the summer. I'm pretty sure there was a press statement about that, and I'd be happy to bring that in. And it would be great, Mr. Chair, Mr. Osberg, I think in the new year when there is a new commissioner to have this discussion one more time. Can you let me know, Mr. Commissioner, if you have calculated the conversion costs yet, what the costs will be, so that you can attach a figure to that 10% state funding that we would have to come up with in order to modernize and simplify our systems?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, again, you're referring to automation of eligibility system. What would it take for us to take Maxis and MMIS and develop something new that supports the exchange as well as supports Medicaid program? We do not know that number yet. We hope it's not going to be very high, because what the federal government is going to do is they're developing the what's called the business rules, because the beauty of the reform law is that now the eligibility standards have been standardized across the board for all states, And there is no asset test, and there's no income disregards, for example. So it's much simpler eligibility criteria for the new program for Medicaid for these populations. It does not affect people with disabilities and seniors. We still have the complication of those eligibility criteria. So we're hoping that the federal government, in fact, the HIT committee of the Office of National Coordinator, are working on business rules and criteria by which states can then take those rules and adopt them. And again, I'm not sure how technically it will work, but adopt them, those criteria, and put them into a rules engine that can then house this eligibility system. So we're hoping that the cost is not significant, but we don't know that number yet, and I'm not sure when we'll know that number. This issue is going to certainly be presented to the new administration about the need for looking at this early on. And we hope to have an estimate as to what that 10% looks like as soon as possible. But until we know what from the federal government as to exactly how they're going to develop the business rules, as they say, around this, we won't know what our costs may look like.
Well, Mr. Asberg, the Department of Human Services, Health and Human Services in Washington is having a meeting at the end of this week for state regulators and state staff people to look at how to do an exchange. Is your department sending anybody to that meeting?
Mr. Chairman, we have some people right now that are in D.C. regarding working with the Office of National Coordinator on the HIT component of that. We've been very busy and very involved with HHS at every level in terms of the exchange development. We have participated in the National Governors Association's sponsored events around this. I have been involved as Medicaid director in certainly working with closely with CMS. I've been one of the 10 Medicaid directors working closely with CMS and how best to implement this and going forward, designing any changes that are necessary. We're very actively engaged in working with HHS and CMS, specifically in my case, in making sure that we understand all the possibilities around the exchange and how that interfaces with Medicaid. So yes, we're very active. As to whether or not somebody from the Health Department or Commerce will be at this meeting this week, I'm not sure, but I personally will not be.
And Mr. Asberg, how did Connecticut get their program up and running almost instantly?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know how quickly they got the program up and running. They got quick approval from CMS when they enacted this. An effective date was back in April. And I don't know, and what they have structured is something very similar to what we have structured in terms of, except a 60% federal poverty guideline standard. But it's a full Medicaid benefit set and eliminated asset test. But I don't know how quickly they got it up and actually operating. Again, they had authorization to proceed very quickly from CMS, but we could find that out as how quick and how they did that. We'd be glad to research that for you.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Asberg? Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Asberg, could you walk me through the timeline? And let's assume the incoming governor signs it on January 3rd. With the quarter system and those benchmarks, when would we be operational? And then you said there was a 90-day retroactive period. So in terms of when those dollars would flow, what is the earliest date from your perspective, working with your technical people and getting everything up and operating beginning January 3rd?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, October 1st is the date, is the projection date at this point for being operational and having all the counties be positioned to manage.
So that's program. What I wanted to get clarified. You'd mentioned that earlier. So then the 90-day retroactivity would go back from October 1st.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson,
that
right, for anybody who applies on October 1st or after, we look back 90 days to see if there's any expenses that they incurred, not necessarily paid out, but incurred. And those expenses would be included in terms of being covered in by the program. So the individual will have those expenses picked up. Now, that does not help the issue that Representative Huntley talked about state costs and retroactive. That's a separate issue. That happens after October 1st for anything back to October 1. Is the retroactive provision for capturing any state costs, and that's a different recovery.
Mr. Osberg, I thought that that retroactivity went quarter by quarter, so that if you come in on October 1st, you can't go back because that's the beginning of a new quarter.
No, Mr. Chairman, the retroactive aspect on quarter to quarter relates to the state plan amendment. In other words, if we were operational October 1, we could submit a state plan amendment any time during that fourth quarter up to December 31st. And so if we had a state plan amendment approved in December, it would be retroactive to October 1. So the quarter issue is the approval of the state plan amendment, not the retroactive coverage of or recovery of costs incurred by the state or by the individual. That's a third retroactive component that relates to the authorization of the state. That's why we're saying that state plan amendment is not the issue at all, because we can submit the state plan amendment any time during the quarter in which after the program becomes operational, and we'll get approval. So submitting the state plan amendment, which we'll do anyway, because we've been encouraged to do that by you and your counterpart in the Senate, we will do that right away. But it has no effect until the program is operational. So it's that you got to separate state plan approval from approval or operational aspects of the program or actual recovery of federal money.
Other questions?
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Osberg. If you are proposing that it's going to take until October 1st to get this up and running, then would we be taking advantage of that time in doing an overhaul of all of our public programs and the eligibility in the systems and getting it all done at one time?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, again, we got to separate the automation of eligibility. That's a separate undertaking. That will not be done in the next 9 months. We're doing an online application. If you recall that we received money from the federal government to develop our state health assistance program, and some of those monies are going to be used for online application. That will be done by this summer. So we feel real good about that. We hope that program can continue, even though the reform law was enacted. There's another 3 years of that grant available, and so hopefully that will continue. So we're not going to do automated eligibility by October 1. If we did that, and if we waited for that, we'll wait. It's 3 years, not 9 months, because it's going to take us 2 or 3 years to get the automated eligibility system up and going. But until we get some guidance from the federal government, we can't even start that effort. And so that's separate from getting all the conversions, the systems conversions, and MMIS and MAXIS done. That's what has to happen in the next 9 months, and then we have to prepare the delivery system for this, managed care or fee-for-service. We have to do the accountable care organization development. Remember, the law instructs us to develop ACO arrangements in Hennepin and Ramsey County as part of this law. That's going to take us some time. So I didn't even get into those parts of the program that we have to operationalize in terms of the delivery system for this population. This will take time to do that. That's why I've not... Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, I wish it could be done before October 1 myself. I really do. I really do. But I am relying on our experts on this. And if, we're glad to bring them in to talk to you about the specifics if you wish to hear about
it. And final question, Mr. Osberg. You're going to have PMAP or managed care contracts with the insurance companies for medical assistance starting January 1, is there going to be any allowance in those contracts for the early MA that's likely to start in October?
Mr. Chairman, it's a very good question. At this point, we have not allowed for that. We will amend those contracts for the early option. Now, it's not so clear reading the law as to whether or not the legislature was intending to have this done through managed care or through fee-for-service. There is some inconsistent provisions about that. Because in one hand, we're supposed to develop these accountable care organizations with Hennepin and Ramsey County, which implies fee-for-service. On the other hand, there's overriding language that says that we're to do managed care arrangements. So I think it's one thing we need to talk about during the session here is what extent, what should we be doing? Should we enroll these people in managed care, or should we develop using our healthcare home model that we have up and running now and our ACO model that we're hoping to be the future? Should we have these people provide care through our fee-for-service side of our arrangement? That's something I think needs to be talked about very soon.
Well, thank you, Mr. Osberg, for your testimony.
Thank you.
And lastly, we're going to have somebody from State Operated Services talk about the reforms going on there.
She fell down.
It's out of my view there. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Tessner. I'm the Chief Executive for State Operated Services. And I'm understanding there's questions about the implementation of the changes in State Operated Services that were discussed last session. What I would do to answer that is talk about, just remind the committee what the changes initially that were proposed during the session. Those that were implemented during session, because if you recall, some of those were implemented in the status of those, and then take any questions you may have. That's satisfactory. I'll begin. If you recall, at the beginning this time last year, State Operated Services was facing $17 million worth of budget pressure that was accounted for in a number of different items. There were some legislative actions that accounted for $3.3 million of that, unfunded operating costs to the tune of $4 million, operating loss for the State Operated Services Dental Clinic, which was approximately $2.6 million, an allotment allocation that was totaled $5 million, and then a $2.2 million budget proposal cut, totaling a little over $17 million. In order to manage that pressure, we had proposed during the session to close and transition a number of different programs. That included closing the CBHH, Community Behavioral Health Hospital, out of Cold Spring, closing the Mankato Crisis Unit, closing the Eveleth Adult Transition Program, transitioning a portion of the dental services to other providers, cutting approximately 50% of the dental services, a little more than 50%, transitioning the CBHH in Wadena and Wilmer to a subacute level of care, transitioning one unit at Anoka to a psychiatric nursing facility located in St. Peter, transitioning the Minnesota Neurorehab Hospital in Brainerd into a subacute level of care, transitioning the MEDO program from a long-term residential to a subacute level of care. And then we also had additional cost savings, operational cost savings, looking at more efficient operation of things like cell phones, pagers, cars, and some staffing associated with that as well. Primarily, the savings there would come through staff reductions, and we projected a loss of 220 FTEs at that point in order to achieve those savings and accomplish those changes. During the session, I believe it was in April of this year, we did in fact close the Cold Spring Hospital, the Mankato Crisis Unit, the Eveleth program, and we began the transition of the Wadena and the Wilmer programs to subacute levels of care. During the session, both in this committee as well as in the Senate, There was a great deal of concern about continuing that process, and there were adjustments made in our budget to ensure that that the other changes were delayed or stopped altogether. So where we are today, the Cold Spring Hospital has been closed and staff have been either reassigned or laid off. I have some numbers on staffing I'll get to in a moment. The Mankato Crisis Unit was closed and transitioned to a, I believe the local mental health center is operating a crisis unit in that the site that we were operating in. The Eveleth program has been closed, and we are now negotiating with the city of Eveleth, who owns the property, and a couple other interested parties in leasing that space and stabilizing the that health complex in downtown Eveleth. We have initiated a request to amend the rate structure for the dental clinics, so those have been stabilized and are currently operating. We haven't received the approval for that rate, but it's been submitted to CMS. The Wadeen and Wilmer CBHHs have been transitioned to a subacute level of care. Wadena has received approval for a rate structure, and we're awaiting a review by the Department of Health, and we expect that early in January. We're anticipating Wilmer will move to that level of care in terms of the rate structure and in the Department of Health survey sometime late January, early February. We, at the direction of the legislature, we did not close the unit at Anoka and transition it those patients to the St. Peter facility, so that was stopped. The Minnesota New Rehab Hospital, if you recall, the problem there was that CMS was interpreting the rehab hospital requirements very differently than they had been for the last 15 years, making it no longer possible for us to operate that as a hospital. It has been transitioned into a subacute level of care, and we're working now with the staffing to adjust that. The certification of that program will happen sometime after Wilmer, which means probably March or April. The transition to the Mito service, we are moving that from a long-term residential program to a 16-bed subacute level of care, and we're working now to determine does that fit into a an ERT funding package or not, and if not, what is the alternative certification that we can achieve. Impact on staffing, if you recall, initially we were projecting as many as 220 FTEs, which would have been actually more employees than that because we have a reliance on a number of part-time staff in all of our programs. The actual number of staff laid off, this is full-time, part-time, was 75. Of those 75, 35 individuals were actually laid off. 17 of the 35, about half of those, took voluntary layoff. When we start staff reductions, we always do a voluntary first so that individuals that may want to, for whatever their reason may be, choose layoff, get to do that, which reduces the number of employees that have to be laid off forcefully. So 17 of the 35 layoffs were voluntary. 15 individuals took jobs from less senior staff. 23 people took jobs elsewhere within the department, state operating services or other state agencies, and we had two retirements. So of the 75, 35 went through layoff, 40 chose another job or took another job someplace else. That's
Mr.
where
Kisner,
we are.
What happened to the dental services? Was that in Cambridge?
We have five dental clinics located throughout the state, Fergus, Brainerd, Cambridge, Southern Cities, which is down in Faribault, and Wilmer. They're all operational at present. Wilmer only has a day or a half day a week, I believe, because the number of folks we see out there is relatively slight. But the dental clinics are all operational. We've submitted the amendment request to CMS to amend the rate so that the rate will fully cover the costs, and we anticipate that we'll receive that, and that will fully fund the dental clinics.
So you did not downsize them?
We did not downsize them.
Other questions for Mr. Tesner?
Well, thank you very much for your testimony. And since this is probably the last meeting of this committee, and at least for a period of time, the last time I'll be chair, I would like to thank the staff. Lynn Aves is still here. Randy Chun was here earlier. And journalists, Jan Horner, but occasionally the Policy Committee and the Human Services Committee, Finance Committee, rather, have done a lot of things together this year. So thank you for your help. And then Dan Pollack has done a wonderful job this year. And it was great. And before him, it was Jen Holcomb who did a wonderful job. And so I'd like to thank them all for the great job they've done in making my time a lot easier. So thank you very much, and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.